This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinians denounce Israel's decision to tighten the siege on the Gaza Strip by shutting a major border crossing. The final duel on for French presidency, who will be the next tenant of the Elysee Palace. Voters will choose if an incumbent Macron and his rival will pan. And also in the headlines, fighting raging in the eastern part of Ukraine as Russian military offensive enters its third month. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Israel says it is closing the only crossing for Palestinian workers coming from the Gaza Strip. Palestinians have denounced that move as collective punishment. The regime says the closure is in response to alleged air raids conducted by the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. Workers' Union in Gaza criticized the measure, saying it hurts the area's already suffering economy. Hamas officials have also slammed it as a form of unacceptable aggression aimed at tightening the siege on Palestinians. The resistance's spokesperson told the media that such collective punishments against Palestinians have always proved to fail. Author and Middle East expert Kevin Barrett says that Israeli measures against Palestinians fit the very definition of genocide.
These 2 million people are packed into 140 square miles. It's the most densely populated zone on Earth. And the Zionists have essentially locked it down and maintained this siege for 15 years now, choking off food and medical supplies and basically, you know, measuring the calories so they can theoretically sort of barely keep everyone alive but without any surplus. So this is an ongoing human rights atrocity. It fits the definition of genocide. Well, the larger war on the Palestinian people fits that definition, according to various scholars of international law. And this crackdown on the current exit of Gaza, preventing people from working, is probably going to just lead to a more tit-for-tat escalation. And it seems that the Zionists are seeking that because they've attacked the Masjid al-Aqsa during the holy month of Ramadan and engaged in other provocations over in the occupied West Bank So it does seem that for whatever reasons, they're in that part of their cycle where they're trying to ramp up tensions and create problems.
The United Nations is demanding impartial and independent investigations into escalating violence in occupied Palestine. The spokesman for the UN Human Rights Office is gravely concerned about the growing atrocities and the excessive use of force by the Israeli military. Ravina Shamdasani says that numerous videos have raised serious concerns about the conduct of the Israelis, which is widespread, unnecessary, and indiscriminate. According to the official, many Palestinians have been beaten, shot with sponge-tip bullets, and sustained serious injuries. Over the past month, Israeli forces have killed and wounded scores of Palestinians and arrested hundreds in the occupied territories, including at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, your host Ali Reza. The situation is escalating once again in the occupied Palestinian territories as Israeli forces once again attack the Muslim holy site of Al-Aqsa Mosque on the third Friday of the, again, Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound while thousands of worshippers had gathered there for their early morning prayers. Israelis used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the Palestinians. Meanwhile, social media is filled with comments, pictures, and videos of the atrocities that the Israelis are committing against the Palestinians in the occupied territories and especially in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They try to reflect the reality of what is happening on the ground in Al-Quds while the Western mainstream media is busy with the war in Ukraine. Our first tweet of the day comes from Sara Ray. She said, Israel is using drones to drop tear gas on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's Friday and men and women and children from across Palestine have come to pray at the holy site. The next tweet comes from Omar Qarayeb. He says, attacking unarmed worshippers at their place of worship in a holy month, injuring over 40 of them, including medics, storming into a place of worship and using excessive force. Welcome to the Israeli occupation forces and its moral army. Aisha said Israeli occupation forces impede the arrival of large numbers of Palestinians heading from the West Bank to perform the third Friday prayer of Ramadan in the blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque Friday morning. As Israeli forces grow more aggressive against the Palestinians become more determined in standing united and defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They say that unity and determination and resistance is the key in resisting against the Israeli occupation, and this is the key to deterring them from implementing their malicious schemes. Leila Barhoun says, while we teach the world the justice of our cause, while we defend our truth, while we protect the identity of a stolen land, while we make the most of the little we have, we walk proud and undefeated. So this powerful photo is of the Palestinians in Bethlehem who are forcing Israeli soldiers to retreat and allow them to enter Al-Quds via a checkpoint for them to be able to perform their Friday prayers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Lola Kantika says, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. A little girl chanting, Palestine will be free, during a protest outside the Israeli embassy in London. Palestine will be free! Pollyanna has our next tweet. There's nothing holy about Israel. The sooner the Western countries realize this, the better. And it's not anti-Semitic to say this. We're speaking on behalf of the Palestinians who are Semites. In the face of continued Israeli crimes and atrocities, the Palestinian people pledge to stand united and fight until the oppression of their people is over and their stolen land is freed. Our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Ayman Arshed. I swear this human chain is more powerful
than your weapons with a really powerful picture attached to it. Jisr Collective says, the revolutionary unified voices of Palestine is heard across the resisting world. Together we will dismantle imperialism, capitalism, and settler colonialism. Our next tweet comes from Ibrahim Abdurrahman Abdi. There is no country called Israel. It's an illegal occupation surviving on veto powers from those who are also war criminals. Back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Okay, that was some social media reactions. Now, moving on, a conference has been held in the Syrian capital Damascus for Palestinian youth. The event was organized amid continuous Israeli crimes against Palestinians in Al-Quds, which was the core subject of that event. Mohammed Ali from Damascus has the details.
The 16th session of the Quds Conference for Palestinian Youth was held in Damascus. Participants discussed means of uniting Palestinians in service of their cause, hailing resistance operations in occupied Palestine and the people's uprising in the face of Israeli forces.
Our message at this conference is that Palestinian youth outside Palestine are present on the front lines, just like the youth in Quds, Gaza and the West Bank. Palestinians are uniting. The Sword of Palestine battle reflects this unity, and this conference is one of the results of that battle.
The conference is held in parallel with the International Al-Quds Day, which was set by late Imam Khomeini on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan every year.
The message of Iran on Quds Day is that the only path for regaining Palestinian rights is resistance against the crimes of the Zionist entity. The message of Quds International Day is Islamic unity in the face of Israeli crimes. The track of normalization will not affect regaining Palestinians' rights.
We as Palestinian, Syrian and Arab youth send a message to our people in Quds in Aqsa Mosque that we will support them until the liberation of Palestine, from the sea to the river. Thanks to the Resistance Alliance, today we are more capable of triumphing. And as Imam Khamenei said, Quds will remain the axis.
The final communique called for national unity among all Palestinian factions, as well as re-establishing the PLO with the national plan based on resistance against the Israeli enemy. Events like this reiterate that Palestinian refugees across the world will never give up their right of repatriation. It's a message to Israel that their struggle will never stop until ending the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Okay, over to France now. Polls are open there with incumbent President Emmanuel Macron and his far-right rival Marine Le Pen fighting a final duel in the race for the top job. Some 49 million French are eligible to vote in the hotly contested runoff. Opinion polls predicting Macron to come out winner. The victory will make him the first French president to be re-elected in two decades. But Macron says that that's not final and has pleaded with voters to turn out in large numbers to avert a shock shift to the far right. And that amid Le Pen's insistence that opinion polls giving Macron the lead would be proved wrong. The two also faced off in the 2017 elections when Macron won by a decisive margin. Moving on, Russian forces pound cities and towns in southern and eastern Ukraine as the war between the two neighbors enters its third month. The biggest battle revolves around the southeastern port city of Mariupol, where Russia has resumed its assault on the last Ukrainian forces holed up inside a giant steel plant. President Zelensky has warned that peace talks with Moscow would be suspended if his soldiers were killed. Meantime, in the eastern Lugansk region, Ukrainian officials say that Russian strikes on the village of Girsk have killed six civilians. Local officials say that eight people, including a three-month-old baby, lost their lives when Russia fired cruise missiles at the city of Odessa. Moscow has denied targeting civilians. Russia says its forces destroyed a logistics terminal in the Black Sea port that held a large batch of weapons delivered by the U.S. and EU. The Saudi-led coalition is refusing to authorize commercial flights out of Yemen's capital despite a ceasefire agreement in place. National carrier Yemenia says that the first commercial flight from Sana'a in 6 years has been indefinitely postponed. The plane was due to take patients in need of medical treatment to Jordan's capital, Amman. The arrangement was part of a two-month UN-mediated truce between Yemen's Ansar Allah movement and the Saudi-led coalition in early April.
The airport in Sana'a has been closed to commercial traffic since August 2016, when airstrikes by the Saud-led coalition disrupted service to the city. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have lost their lives directly and indirectly due to the war and blockade that Saudi Arabia and its allies started 7 years ago. Yemen is crippled by poverty, hunger, and disease. More than 70% of the population is in need of humanitarian assistance. In Sri Lanka, government loyalists are calling on the Prime Minister to quit, and this as protest pressure keeps mounting over the worsening economic crisis. Media Minister Nalaka Godahiwa and other senior party members demand the resignation of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and his brother, Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa. The media minister also called for the resignation of the entire cabinet for an all-inclusive interim government to take over. Godahiwa says that the government lost its credibility after the police killing of a protester on Tuesday. The president has already sacked three cabinet members, but protesters say that these cosmetic changes aren't enough. The island nation is in the grip of its worst ever economic crisis, with people facing power cuts and shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. The situation has ignited protests with angry demonstrators camping outside the presidential office for more than 3 weeks. Multiple bomb attacks on the Hazara community in Afghanistan have left dozens of families in great sorrow. Relatives of the victims calling for justice and an end to the violence. Our correspondent has a report from Kabul.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents and some their children. Here, we are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on school students, Mir Hussein went to bring his son home. But he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Chinese city of Shanghai is reporting its highest daily COVID toll of nearly 40 since it started enforcing its strict lockdown weeks ago. The cosmopolitan business hub has been almost entirely locked down since the start of the month, when it became the epicenter of the outbreak. The lockdown has snarled supply chains, with food supply for the confined residents turning into a major issue for the urban managers. Meanwhile, in Beijing, 22 new infections have been reported. Officials warning of a grim situation in the capital where COVID continues to spread. China has been struggling to stamp out its worst outbreak in 2 years with harsh lockdowns and mass testing. Some 100 people have died in an explosion at an illegal oil refining depot in Nigeria's Rivers Estate. The incident occurred after a fire outbreak at the bunkering site. The victims were burnt beyond recognition. Unemployment and poverty in the Niger Delta have made illegal crude refining an attractive business in Nigeria. Crude oil is tapped from a maze of pipelines owned by major oil companies and refined into products in makeshift tanks. The hazardous process has led to many fatal incidents. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after
better than my present hour and my today, and exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We humans commit sin because of negligence. In other words, we forget God's commands and trespass his red lines. In such cases, God has ordered us to repent and return to the right path. Nevertheless, some of us have repented several times and breached our penitence and committed sins again and again. Some of us have plunged in sins to the extent that we despair of God and do not think of penitence at all. Insistence on sin is very bad, but being disappointed of God's mercy is worse and more reprimanded. God says to the prophet in Ayah 53 of Surah Zumar, "Say, O my servants who have committed excesses against their own souls, do not despair of God's mercy. Indeed, Allah forgives all sins. Indeed, He is the all-forgiving, the all-merciful." This ayah is full of grace and mercy of God. Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Be hopeful of God's mercy, the mercy which does not embolden you to disobey Him, and have fear of God, the fear which does not make you desperate of His mercy." God tells the prophet in Ayah 60 of Surah Ghafir, "Your Lord has said, 'Call me and I will hear you.' Indeed, those who are disdainful of my worship will enter hell in utter humility." This ayah both makes us hopeful of God's mercy and warns against His wrath and punishment. The result of fearing God is giving up sins, and the result of hope in His mercy is to do righteous deeds. Part of Ayah 110 of Surah Kahf reads, "Whoever expects to encounter his Lord, let him act righteously." Here, it is clear that hoping God must be accompanied with righteous deeds, otherwise it would be lie.
Thank you.
In the month of Ramadan, the individual is permitted to eat and drink of God's blessings from the dusk till the dawn. Having food before the dawn has been recommended as it gives energy to the body. But a common mistake is to have the pre-dawn meal hurriedly. This will cause ailments in both the stomach and the intestines. It will have negative effect on digestive system and will cause reflux of the stomach during the day. Although sleeping is very sweet in pre-dawn hours, it has been highly recommended to have this meal, which is called suhoor or sahari. It is good to regulate the volume of food in iftar in a way that the stomach is ready for another meal before the dawn. Fasting makes the heart luminous, and the individual tastes the sweetness of prayer and supplication with the Lord of creation. Worships in Ramadan make the spirit lighter and leads us to recognize God better. It is the month of adorning the soul and spirit with moral virtues via faith and righteous deeds. The ninth infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Jawad, peace upon him, has said in a supplication, O God, O you who administer the affairs and have power over all things, O you who know the betrayal of eyes and what the chest conceal and what the inward hides, O God, place us among those who make intention and follow it with practice, and do not place us among those who are wretched and rely on other than work. O God, heal the diseases of our bodies and help us practice what you have obligated on us so that this month passes while we have fulfilled in it your obligation on us. O God, help us for fasting of this month and keeping vigil at night, and grant us liveliness in this month for performing ritual prayer. And do not deprive us from recitation of the Quran, and facilitate for us the giving of alms. O God, do not dominate chronic diseases, tiredness, ailment, and fatigue over us. O God, give us halal sustenance for iftar. O God, facilitate for us what you have sustained in this month, and pave the way for what you have determined of your affair, and make it halal, pure and clean from sins and evils. O God, do not feed us except pure food, not polluted and haram, and make your sustenance halal for us, devoid of dirt and ailments. Imam Jawad, peace upon him, says in another supplication in this month, O God, greet Muhammad and his infallible Ahlul Bayt and accept our fast and join it with good deeds and God-weariness and appreciate our effort and accept our keeping night vigil and the Quran that we have recited and answer out prayers and guide us to good deed and keep us aloof from hardships and prepare us for easy affairs and elevate our degrees and double our virtuous deeds and accept our ritual prayers so that the month of Ramadan passes by us while you have accepted our fast and keeping night vigil and cleansed and purified our deeds and forgiven our sins and fulfilled our share completely in this month of every goodness, as you are the answerer and near Lord, and you encompass everything.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Whenever people talk about the war in Ukraine, they tend to focus on what's happening inside Ukraine. You know, the battles taking place in Mariupol, the Donbass, or the outskirts of Kiev. But that's just half the story. The war in Ukraine is really a catalyst. It's pushing the world towards a multipolar order. Now, right this moment, we are seeing a global realignment. And I don't just mean the shifting of alliances. We're talking about the future of energy sales, global supply chains, the redistribution of power from the concentrated hands of a few in the West towards Asia. This is a seismic shift, both in size and nature, that could very well determine the future of international politics for the next decades. Now, if I told you 2 months ago that EU member states would be paying for their gas in rubles, you would never have believed me. And yet here we are, where the dominance of the US dollar, of the euro, are being challenged. And while the Western press want you to believe that the whole world is united and has the exact same position on Russia, it couldn't be further from the truth. So maybe it really is time to take a hard look at what the so-called international community really means and where it's headed. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States of America has been the global superpower during the 21st century up until this point, and for the better part of the last century. And one of the things that the U.S. derives much of its power from is its currency, the U.S. dollar. So toward the end of World War II in 1944, you had the Bretton Woods system that was put in place, pegging the U.S. dollar to the gold standard. And as a result, the U.S. dollar de facto became the global reserve currency. And that lasted for a few decades, right? And then from 1968 to 1973, that system fell apart. And what emerged soon thereafter in its place was the petrodollar. The United States, in secret, made an agreement with Saudi Arabia, right? They told the Saudis, we'll give you weapons, we'll give you security. And in exchange, the Saudis would conduct all oil sales in U.S. dollars and buy up U.S. bonds. 80% of all oil transactions are conducted in U.S. dollars. Around 55% of global reserves are in U.S. dollars. But now, because of the war in Ukraine, that could very well change. We've had several shocking developments in the last week that you would have never imagined before, right? So because of the war in Ukraine, the U.S., the EU, they have slapped Russia with sanctions to the point that Russia is now the most sanctioned country on earth with well over 5,530 sanctions. The EU sanctioned everything except Russian energy imports, because the EU relies on Russia, right? About 40% of their gas comes from Russia. However, the UK, the US, they went ahead and straight up banned Russian energy imports. And even though the US isn't a major importer of Russian oil, that announcement of, oh, we're thinking about banning Russian oil, and then actually banning Russian oil, this caused gas prices and oil prices to skyrocket. Oil went up to around $135 a barrel. That's the highest we've seen since July 2008. Gas prices also went up dramatically, Dutch and British. And now all of a sudden, the US is panicking because the US is a net importer of oil. So their oil bill is going way up. And so in order to drive the price back down, the Americans are trying several things, right? First of all, they called up the Saudis and the Emiratis and asked them, please produce more oil. We need to calm global prices. But turns out Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, he won't even take Joe Biden's phone call. You know, apparently they're unhappy because the United States isn't giving them enough support to kill more Yemenis. Then the United States sent a delegation to Venezuela. Remember, Venezuela sits on the world's largest reserves of oil. And the U.S. used to be one of their top customers, you know, until Bush, Obama, Trump sanctioned them into oblivion. Now, what's funny here is that for years we've been hearing from the U.S. and their allies that Nicolas Maduro is not the president of Venezuela. Apparently, the president is some guy that no one's ever heard of in Venezuela called Juan Guaido. But now, all of a sudden, when the Americans need oil, oh, now they recognize who's the real president, and they're sending a delegation to beg for oil. And again, who are they talking to? Who's the decision maker? Well, I can tell you it's not Juan Guaido, because they went to speak to none other than Maduro. Now, if the Americans are begging Venezuela for oil and begging Maduro for oil, you know the situation is dire. And on top of that, the Americans have tried other ways to bring down oil prices, right? So all of a sudden, after dragging their feet for well over a year, all of a sudden the U.S. wants to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Wow. So remember, the idea is that they lift sanctions on Iran. Iran can put its oil back on the global market, and then oil prices go down because the supply is increased. Well, that didn't happen because of multiple reasons. Russia demanded a written guarantee that Iran won't be hit with fresh sanctions for maintaining ties with Russia. However, it's also been reported there are additional details that had to be ironed out, the terrorism designations and so on. The point is, this sudden enthusiasm and this rush from the Americans to finish up the deal, it really shows their desperation. And the United States have basically sanctioned so many people, they've sanctioned everyone, that they've backed themselves into a corner. And who has the upper hand now? Russia, Iran, Venezuela. Let me tell you, that is quite the twist, right? You're really seeing the tables turn right before you. And to make matters worse for Washington, Saudi Arabia not only refused to take their calls, but was even contemplating selling oil to China, not in US dollars, but in yuan, in China's currency, the renminbi. So basically saying, bye-bye, petrodollar. Remember, the entire premise behind the greenback's value is that major oil sales, energy sales, are denominated in US dollars. Now, China imported roughly 17% of its oil from Saudi Arabia in 2021, so this is no joke. At the same time, instead of sanctioning Russia like everybody else, New Delhi struck a deal with Moscow for 3 million barrels of crude. Now, the amount is irrelevant because India consumes more than that in a single day. But the fact that India traded with Russia, continued to maintain ties with Russia, bought this oil at a discount and in rupees, rubles, so dealing another blow to the US dollar. So China refuses to sanction Russia. India and Pakistan refuse to sanction Russia. They're continuing to buy gas and oil like normal, right? Despite the threats to India that it will also face sanctions. That doesn't sound very isolating, right? That's roughly 40% of the world's population there, refusing to toe the Western narrative, refusing to toe the Western line, I should say. And never mind all the other countries that have also refused to condemn Russia. Just look at this map of who has sanctioned Russia. It's basically EU member states, North America, and Japan. And Australia. So in other words, it's the global north, right? This is where all the world's wealth is hoarded. And you know, all the countries that have not sanctioned Russia are mostly countries you would consider the global south, right? So there's an interesting pattern right there. Western governments and media, they keep saying the international community is united against Russia. I'm sorry, that's not what it looks like. The West is not the international community, it's the West. or the global north, if you want to use the new terms, right? So as a matter of fact, it goes further than that. Let's look at these two UN votes. On March 2nd, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution condemning Russia. The overwhelming majority of countries did vote to condemn Russia. That's undeniable. But if you look at who abstained, we have Iran, Iraq, China, India, Pakistan, South Africa. Again, that is enormous. That's well over a third of the world's population, you know, above 40%. We're nearing half the world's population. And so later on March 24th, another General Assembly resolution and pretty much the same result. And 2 days before that, on March 22nd, you had a meeting in Moscow between the Russian foreign minister and who? The ambassadors of all the emerging economic powers, the BRICS, right? So you've got the ambassadors of Brazil, India, China, South Africa, meeting in Moscow with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. Again, that doesn't really look very isolating to me, does it? So you've got the two most populous countries on Earth, two nuclear powers, meeting in Russia's capital with Lavrov. I bet you didn't hear about that on the BBC. Now, Lavrov actually made his first visit to China since the war began, just a week later on March 30th. Right? Soon thereafter, Lavrov actually visited India on April 1st. And now, India has received many visits, many official visits in the past week. You've had officials from the UK, from Greece, Austria, Mexico. They've all come to India. But the only one that India's Prime Minister Modi met with was Lavrov. And again, that pretty much tells you everything you need to know. But this war in Ukraine hasn't been without its setbacks, right? When we talk about a global realignment, that goes both ways. And so we've seen the European Union openly arming Ukraine. That's unprecedented. Germany, the same thing, right? Germany has broken with its past, with its stated stance of neutrality. And Germany's going even further. It's rearming. And I think this is something that not a lot of people really grasp. They don't understand how serious this is, that Germany is rearming. That never ends up well. The last time Germany rearmed, we had a Second World War. We had the Holocaust. We had 30 million dead in Europe alone. And now Germany is basically doing what Donald Trump wanted it to do, what NATO wanted it to do, which is increase their defense spending from 1.5 to 2% of their GDP. So Germany's announced 100 billion euros for its military. That's more than Russia. This is incredible, and it could have very, very severe repercussions down the road. Now, as soon as the war started, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan went to Moscow. He not only met with Putin, he also bought 2 million tons of gas and wheat. He refused to condemn Russia at the UN. He refused to sanction Putin. And the Americans took offense to that, right? Because they want countries they can control. And so soon thereafter, Imran Khan unveiled a plot by the United States to oust him, to unseat him from power. Lo and behold, here we are. And Imran Khan has just been ousted via a vote of no confidence. And like all Pakistani prime ministers before him, he didn't get to complete his five-year term. The Americans are like the mafia. They don't forget, and they punished Imran Khan for daring to conduct an independent foreign policy. And that's the grim reality, right? That shifting towards a multipolar world doesn't come without a price, and the American empire will kick and scream and take down as many with it as it can. To punish Russia, we've seen many corporations pulling out, from McDonald's to Instagram, you name it. And among those are credit card giants Visa and MasterCard, which is actually not that smart when you think about it, because what they've basically done is they handed their market share in Russia to China, right? Because as soon as they left, China's UnionPay came into Russia and linked up with Russia's payment system, Mir, M-I-R. And to make things even more interesting, while all this was happening, Iran and Venezuela started talks to link their payment systems to Russia's Mir. So, you know, further enlarging the cooperation, the international cooperation between these countries, further enhancing the economic ties between the axis of resistance, between the global south. So the West attempts to crush Russia's financial system, you know, by freezing roughly half of the Russian central bank's foreign assets. They haven't entirely succeeded, because as a matter of fact, if you look right now at the value of the Russian ruble, it's regained a lot of its value. It's almost back to pre-war levels at 80 rubles to the dollar. And of course, there are people who say, well, this is just artificial, it's just temporary. Yeah, but it's still astounding. You know, Russian President Vladimir Putin told the Russian Central Bank and he told Gazprom, the state-owned gas company, to come up with a plan by March 31st to make sure that all gas payments from unfriendly countries be conducted in rubles, not euros or dollars. And again, this is a monumental shift because, as we were saying, most oil and energy transactions are denominated in US dollars. Actually, most of Russia's gas sales to Europe are in euros. And so when Putin says unfriendly countries, he's talking mostly about the EU, the US, Japan, Norway, the countries that sanctioned Russia. And that alone helped shore up the value of the ruble as European countries, which again, collectively, they get 40% of their gas from Russia. So, you know, they have no choice. They have to go now to Gazprom Bank and open an account in rubles, where their euros will be taken, they'll be sold for rubles in their name at the Moscow Stock Exchange, and then pay for the gas, then also used to pay for the gas in their name. So not only does that drive up the demand for rubles, but it's also smart because it means European buyers are now opening accounts at a Russian bank and not the other way around. So this further insulates both the money itself by keeping it in Russia and Gazprom Bank from potential sanctions in the future. And Joe Biden, the US president, he made clear that there will be food shortages as a result of the conflict. Benchmark gas prices have gone through the roof. People in the US are paying $4 a gallon now. And yes, there was already an energy and fuel crisis before the war. But the Americans and the Europeans have essentially taken a bad situation and made it three times worse. Don't go anywhere. We'll continue breaking down the shift to a multipolar world right after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So as we were looking at the other week in Yemen, when the price of fuel goes up, everything goes up because fuel is one of the most important commodities and affects everything from healthcare to public transport to groceries. Now, earlier I spoke to Scott Ritter about his take on things. Scott is a former intelligence officer in the U.S. Marine Corps. He also served as a United Nations weapons inspector and offers formidable insight, not just in combat-related matters, but international affairs and what it means exactly, you know, transitioning to a multipolar world.
The war in Ukraine is, it's a cleansing moment, and that I don't mean that in a good way. You know, it's like let's say you have a forest that's full of trees that are infected with fungus and insects and all that, and then you have a forest fire come through and burn it all down. That's not necessarily a good thing, except that what emerges in the aftermath of that fire is a viable forest with healthy trees that'll grow better and produce and have a better impact on the environment. What existed prior was just a festering cesspool of infection. The world today is a festering cesspool of infection because of the United States, because of our efforts to impose unilateral hegemony over the world. Ukraine, you can't make the transition from that to what Russia and China are seeking to do without a forest fire. And Ukraine is that forest fire. And it's sad for the Ukrainian people. It's sad for the world. But I think that, for instance, Russia's economic addiction to the West is being broken because of this. The impetus necessary to get Russia to make the strategic pivot away from the West to China and Eurasia is only happening because of this. The liberation of the Russian government from the economic infection of Western influence and the role played by the oligarchs. This is a cleansing moment. There is going to be a radical realignment of centers of gravity in the world. The singular polarity that exists. is being broken apart, and it's going to be spread out. And BRICS is probably the initial model of where these centers of gravity are going to, the new centers of gravity are going to emerge.
So, you know, the Russians have demanded that quote-unquote unfriendly countries start paying for gas in rubles, right? So Hungary, they've just announced that they will follow, they will comply, and they're effectively breaking ranks with the EU in saying that. Do you think there's going to be a domino effect? Do you think that other countries will follow suit?
Absolutely. They have no choice. Austria. How does Austria think it's going to get its gas? Austria is going to be paying in rubles. The Vatican is going to be paying in rubles. Slovakia is going to be paying in rubles. And Germany is going to be paying rubles. They claim they're not going to be, but when the economic reality of what's about to happen to Germany hits home, and I would be willing to put money on the fact that Scholz won't survive the year.
Well, how long do you think that people in the West will tolerate these conditions? You know, higher gas prices, higher food prices. You know, just for the sake of what's being sold in the media as, oh, we're projecting European values and Western values. I mean, how long do you think this is going to go on for? Do you think, you know, there will come a breaking point, or do you think the media are so good at propagandizing people that everyone's just going to tolerate it?
You know, the media works when people come home and they have heat, they have food, and they have comfort. The media doesn't work when you come home and you're cold and you're hungry and you're uncomfortable. There's no amount of propaganda that can change those realities. And the, you know, how long is this going to last until the next election? It's over. There's not a single democracy that will have its current government survive the next election if this policy stays in place and their and the economies of that country tank. No government will survive a tanking economy. None. Now, in the United States, we don't have a parliamentarian system. So it's pretty much accepted right now that the Congress, that we have a midterm election coming up in November, and that the Republicans are going to gain control of Congress because the Democrats can't spend this. No matter how much Americans claim they support the Ukrainians, at the end of the day, high gas prices, high food prices are going to basically dictate that the government in power has failed.
So Russia have pegged the ruble to gold. What do you make of that?
Russia has done something very clever. I mean, how many people before this crisis thought that that Putin would link the ruble to the gold standard? But it happened. And it was a genius move. Because now the ruble, believe it or not, is dictating it. Because the price of gold used to be linked to the dollar. I mean, you know, it's all based upon the dollar. But now by saying that I think it's 5,000 rubles are worth a half a gram of gold or something like that, that value doesn't change. At the end of the day, 5,000 rubles are worth this much gold. And so now it's the dollar that is linked to the ruble, and he's flipped the script. And again, this isn't a temporary measure designed to... If there hadn't been the divorce of the economies, then I would say there's a chance that this is just games. But there's been the divorce of the economy. So there's literally no impetus, no reason for Russia to play temporary games, because they're not going back to the dollar. They're not going back to the euro. They're not going back to the way things were. They're starting anew. This is about empowering the ruble to function in a trans-Eurasian market. Not in an American market, not in a European market, but in a trans-Eurasian market as part and parcel of a currency flux that includes the yuan, the rupee, and other currencies as co-equal currencies of joint, you know, that can be jointly traded. No, Russia, this is the new reality.
You know, let's be clear. This isn't like sanctioning Syria or Iran or Venezuela. The U.S. and the EU, they're so used to bullying smaller countries with zero consequences. But this time, the sanctions go both ways. You know, these bureaucrats in Brussels, they're ready to hurt their own people just to spite Russia. But of course, it's okay for them because they're not the ones who are going to lose their jobs or feel the bite of higher gas prices and food prices. Russia isn't an economic giant like the United States, but it does play a strategic role, and it supplies a good chunk of Europe's gas. You can't just go, yeah, we're going to punish the Russians and forget about it. The ripple effect is going to be enormous. And the West have really shot themselves in the foot, right? Sure, they think they're punishing Russia in the short term, but in the long term, they've helped to speed up the process of de-dollarization and the emergence of a stronger Asia. You know, the West are basically begging Russia and China to find alternatives to SWIFT, to conduct oil and gas sales in denominations other than the US dollar, so either in rupees, rubles, or renminbi. Just to give you another example, on April 8th, China began buying coal and oil from Russia in renminbi. Again, the West are pushing Russia into China's arms and encouraging the global south to break free of the Western financial and monetary system, and proving just how important China's Belt and Road Initiative and Greater Eurasia will be in the future. It's astonishing how the war in Ukraine has led to so many changes on a global scale and sped up the transition to a multipolar world, undermining US hegemony in the process. Now again, no one is saying at the flick of a switch, we're gonna wake up tomorrow and find a multipolar world, but things certainly appear to be shifting in that direction at a faster pace than ever before. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.